let's try to cover what we talked about a little bit when I first got here, because we weren't rolling, but we're talking about how'd that get started with
the lie?
The lying and trying to prevent yourself. Because that's, I listened to the old recording a couple times, and that was one of the things you said a couple times, where when you lit the stove and it went out and all of the wick,
it stayed burning and producing carbon
all over the house, and then he wakes you up by reading you and says, "Did you do that?" And you're like, "No." And I'm saying, of course you said no, because you're trying to live.
Right.
And you're kind of on your own case, like, yeah, but I'm lying, and I don't want to lie because I don't want to become my father.
Right. And when I listened to that same monologue this last time, I was connecting dots I hadn't connected before. And then all of a sudden it made sense to me why it was such a big deal. It's a character issue if you lie or I lie or Mike or anybody. If I have the responsibility as a dad to four kids, then if they grow up to be lying, cheating, bad character people, that's on me. Because they're not really my kids. They're his. And I'm supposed to do something about raising them. Imparting stuff to them. Mostly God stuff. Haven't done a good job of that, that's for sure. But the lying thing was a big issue, because it's a character-based issue. Because if lying is part of your life and it's okay, then it's sociopathic. And it can lead you to mislead other people to get your will instead of God's will to happen. And then that is on me. So I wanted to... Yeah, I related the story about Bob losing his wallet, because when I was 15, there it was. Mm-hmm. I made the decisions.
That was your first day there.
Yeah.
I never knew that.
The first day there, but in that first, I don't know, 6 months or something, first 3 months or something, I underwent a huge change in my own life. By decision, I said, I don't want to lie. I have a chance for a new life. So I don't want to be swearing. I don't want to be lying. I don't want to be cheating. And this is before I'm clear on God. Always was close to God, but I never really came to commit myself to him. I remember Pete LaFerrière and I went to one of those great big stadiums where what's his face, who's now old, was preaching.
Like Oral Roberts or something?
No,
Billy Graham.
Yeah. Billy Graham had a big stadium full of people, and we were in the bleachers up there, and we both went down, committed ourselves to Christ, Pete and me. And of course, we don't talk about that much. He's a Catholic guy, you know. When I went to his wife's, well, best man at his wedding, and he was supposed to go to confession and have that little wafer at the altar at the wedding thing. And so they came to me, and I said, "No thanks." And that was stupid. I mean, that was an embarrassment to everybody in the place, because I had been Catholic, but I hadn't been to confession in forever, you know. And so I wasn't worthy to have that. Plus, I didn't really believe it. I don't thought it was a Christian. It's a Catholic ritual, had nothing to do with God. So, but that's what you mean when I want to go chase here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just going to say, you were talking about your first day at Canusens, because that didn't get on tape.
First day at Canusens.
But you said for the 3 months, first 3 months.
Oh, the first 3 months was a big change. Mm-hmm. So I had to change everything. I changed my diction, my vocabulary, the way I spoke, what I stood for, my work ethic, although it was kind of in me, and and be careful that I didn't get them mad. I didn't want to get them mad because I felt they were really giving me a break nobody had ever given me. So that's where the turn in my life came, and out of that turn came all the other things. Like, didn't want you to lie either. Didn't want anybody that was under my charge to grow up with bad character. All my paint business was all about that. Try to do for them what they wanted, and if there was a discrepancy, I took the loss. When the Heisers and we teamed up on that house, Lois Lane. Remember the Lois Lane house?
No, I know.
Well, that just sounds funny.
We were in together with it. Bought the house, going to fix it up, sell it, all that kind of stuff. Turns out that house wouldn't produce enough to make anything for both of us. And when I realized that, and I realized getting close to Stets economically about that venture, he was paying attention to 50 details I had no mind for. He was concerned about a lot of things that never came into my mind when I was doing some kind of a project like that. So I realized this: I stand a chance of alienating somebody I love. So this is ridiculous. So I said to him, look, this is all yours. I'll help you, but I'm not part of it. I want you to be made whole with this. I don't want anything out of it. I did the same thing with Dale Verrill. So, if there's a possibility of hurting a relationship that you care about like that, I'm not going to be part of that. I'm not going to destroy it. And so he did it. It worked out that it was his house, and he sold it. And I don't even know what happened. I don't know the outcome. But I know what the decisions were. So it's all part of the character shaping. And now that I'm getting older, I'm seeing the things long ago that were impactful result in wisdom if obedience happens in the process. Impact, choose the right thing, no matter the consequence. I remember, you know, if I'm not gonna lie, then I got two options. Somebody asks me a question, I can either say I can't answer you, or I gotta tell them the truth. And the consequences of truth were horrible. I remember as a teenager, consequences of truth in your friendships and in your dating and your romances. And I remember when Jay and I were first going together at UNH, I came home one day. I think we were talking about getting engaged or something with her. And her father didn't want to have anything to do with it. We put the engagement in the newspaper at the college. Mm-hmm. And that's how he found out. He read it in the college newspaper. And, of course, that kind of threw him for a loop. And then he was talking to the Cornelisons about, we're a giving family, but we need time and we can't. We got to, and I kept going, what do you mean you need time? You're not getting married. We're getting married. I was insolent in those days. It was... Like, he used to shake hands with me when I came down to visit him. And he'd have like a $10 bill in it. So one day he came to our house and I went out to meet him.
Oh boy.
I gave him a $10 bill. It was awful. Ellen knitted me a green sweater and I opened the package at Christmas and I said, oh, I hate green. You know, and she knitted a whole sweater. It's just... I mean, why? That's inside voice. What are you doing?
Right.
Say thank you. No, no. But see, you got to say the truth.
I don't know. About that.
Consequences are awful. But
yeah, so. That's an inside voices thing. But
yeah, either that or don't say anything.
Right. Yeah.
Shut up. You don't have to volunteer to be bad, but the truth.
Right. That hurt. I remember that hurt Christy for maybe still when she gave Mike a CD and he opened it and said that he didn't like it.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Well, I thought he said he had one of those already.
No, he said he didn't.
Didn't like it? Yeah, whatever it was. But
well, okay. There's the consequence of telling the truth.
No, but that's one of those times where you can keep it to yourself.
Yeah. Really?
That's funny.
Well, I think you should retell about your first day at Communion since that didn't get on tape.
Yeah.
Because you didn't know any of that stuff, so.
No, I mean, over the span of our lives, I've heard little bits and pieces of stories, and we clarified some in that previous recording. But, yeah, that one, I don't remember.
I can see that like a movie. I remember all the details.
Where were you coming from with
witches? I was living with the Bedlers.
Okay.
And they got me with this guy that had horses. I was shoveling manure, and he took me to his friend, doctor, who's checked my foot and said, hospital now, gave me one of these spinals.
Yeah,
broke
like
my foot.
That one, let's go slower there, because you have told me that, and I remember thinking, I wish I had something recording. But you were limping or something, and the guy you were working for knew a doctor.
Yeah. He was a doctor. The guy I worked for, Dr. Giblin, I think his name was.
But you got fired from a place you were working.
That's a store. When I left home, when I was 15, and Jimmy said, do you want to leave? And I said, sure, what time do you want me back? He said, I don't care. And when he said those I don't care words, the jail door opened wide and I was out of there.
Really?
I had nothing. I had a pair of shoes that were 8.5 D's. They didn't fit my feet. I had a pair of brown gabardine pants and a shirt I don't remember. But that's all I had. That's all I owned. I didn't own any more clothes. And I walked across town to the Vedlers to tell them I was leaving because my hamsters were there. He wouldn't let me keep my hamsters down in the cellar, so I had to get rid of them. So I brought them over to Donnie Vedler's house, and he had some hamsters. And we had an ice chest with a screen so that they all lived in this big ice chest. And I said, these are yours because I'm leaving. What do you mean? I got a chance to leave home, man. I'm out of here. So, and his mother said, where are you going? And I said, I don't know, but I'm going to Massachusetts because he used to drop me off someplace in the summers. And I used to go to that MRC ranch. That's where I learned. That's where I learned some of the stories I tell. French-Canadian stories.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they used to call me Little Ronnie, and they'd have me come up and sing. And I'd even whistle. They thought I was a terrific whistler, right? So, oh man, I'm so sorry. I'm rambling because I'm.
No, that's. I wanted to back up the story.
It's a movie to me.
Yeah, I wanted to hear the whole thing because I've not ever heard that. Like how you got to the Vedlers and why and.
Yeah, that's. It was the hamsters.
Yeah.
And when I. So they gave me. They said it was cold. It was nippy. It was late fall. And I was going to walk or bum to Worcester. I got to Ayer, Massachusetts. And there was a soldier's base there. And I bummed a ride. But they gave me a jacket because it was cold. So now I had a jacket. And it looked like a sports coat that you'd wear with a suit.
Mm-hmm.
And it, when I got cold, I'm bumming and walking toward Nashville. So I'm back through Londonderry and all that. And I put my hand in my pocket because I was getting cold, and there was a $10 bill in there or something. It was a lot of money because at 10 I worked on a farm and I made $10 a week, and it was $9 to buy the groceries for the family. And I remember doing that. So. I'm on the road, and I got to someplace in Massachusetts, and I tried to remember where to go, and somebody let me sleep on their porch. There was a couch on their porch. It was a screen porch.
Somebody?
Yeah, I don't know who it was. I must have known them. I must have known something about them. I don't know. So I was sleeping on their porch, and I was working. I got a job in a grocery store. I was working in a grocery store, and I was bagging groceries, and I was lugging groceries to cars and stuff like that. And we'd go to that Air Force, that Army base, and deliver groceries out there. And I was doing them, but I was hobbling. This thing wouldn't move, so I was gimpy when I walked. So, and then after about a month or so, he said, "What is wrong with your leg?" I said, "I don't know." My stepfather said, "If I go to a doctor, I'll kill myself. I'm not doing that." So he said, "Well, I'm going to have to let you go because I get so many people asking me, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with your foot? Why you walk that way?" Mm-hmm. So I said, "Okay." So I gimped my way out of that store and got back on the road and bummed back to Derry. I remember the guy that gave me a ride, I asked him if he was my father. I didn't know who my father was. I hadn't seen him since I was four. Well, and I remember saying to him, "Are you my father? You know, you want to let me out of the car?" You know, so he wasn't. But that would have been something if he was, you know. But so I got back into town, and I went to Railroad Avenue, and they didn't live there anymore.
They went back to your home?
Yeah. See what's what. And they weren't there anymore. The town had kicked them out. The town had said, "Get out of this town." So that's what I was told anyway. And it wasn't in that tenement building where we lived across from Militia. Her apartment was on the shoe shop side of the street. Ours was on the back side of her apartment. And she remembers me in those days. I don't remember her very much. I remember my phone number was 780J. But she, there was nobody there. So I walked over to the Vedlers and across town over to the Vedlers and told them what the story was. And she said, "Well, one of my sons is in the war and his cot is upstairs. And you can use that cot." So I thanked them.
What does that mean? You can take it and use it, or you can sleep there
can
in their
sleep
house?
I can sleep. Okay. She'll take me in, and I'll sleep there, because I had nowhere to go. Mm-hmm. And she was that kind of lady. So I did dishes and I did whatever I could to help in the house. Still gimping. By then I had a GI boot where no laces in. Put the tongue out as far as you can, widen it as far as you can to get my foot in it, because I couldn't bend my foot to get it in a regular shoe. So I had one big boot. So then she got me a job at Dr. Giblin's place. It was out on Route 28, and I didn't know. I came in the house from playing outside with the kids, and she said, "I got you a job with that Dr. Giblin's. He's got horses, and you can weed the gardens, and you can shovel the manure for the horses, and they'll pay you, and it will give you some money anyway." She had to cart me over there. Well, so one day I was out weeding the garden, and he came out and says, "What's wrong with your foot?" I said, "No, blah, blah." And my father said, "No, no, no, no." So he said, "Well, get in the car." That's where the "get in the car" comes from.
Oh, really?
Do that with the kids.
I always said,
"Get in the car." and so we went to Manchester, and he took me to a colleague of his who was a foot doctor, Dr. Ricks. And he examined both my feet. And he said to Dr. Giblin, "Hospital now." So it was midday. I went into a hospital. They gave me a spinal, and they broke the bones. The bones are growing together. The bones, instead of being up, were down. Mm-hmm. So it was a club foot. And I remember picking my head up to see what all that noise was, you know, mm-hmm. sounded awful. Sounded like Jimmy Lawton. Mm-hmm. So I looked down there and he's banging up an arch into my foot. And then they put a cast on me. She pulled my head back down there and said, "Don't do that. You never pick your head up when you have a spinal." I said, "Oh, yeah, sure." Mm-hmm. Last time I had a spinal was never.
Yeah.
So they put a cast on up to my knee, put me in a hospital bed, and the meddlers came with a pair of tan pajamas. And they had a little thing with a comb in it and a nail file, mm-hmm. and they had a toothbrush. And I figured, what are they thinking? You don't dress up to go to bed, you know. And what's this toothbrush thing?
You had never worn pajamas before?
No.
Never brushed your teeth?
No.
Oh my gosh.
Nope. Never. Wow. I'd never taken a shower.
What did you do? Like take?
I just splash in the sink and, you know, soak myself off. You can actually wash your body with a face cloth or something.
Right.
And
gross.
Yeah, I know. But you know, that's way back when I was four. And Jimmy Lott said, "If you don't keep your face clean, I'm gonna
right
with a wire brush." Well, that's where that. See, there wasn't. There wasn't any hygiene ever taught. There wasn't anything ever expected.
Yeah.
Except it was a chance for him to be sadistic. So anyway, where was I?
You're in the hospital and they brought you pajamas. Okay.
And I figured a comb and a nail file and a toothbrush. What am I going to do with it? And some clothes to wear to bed? I don't wear close to bed, so anyway, I wasn't in the hospital very long. I think it was a day or something. They sent me home, and they sent me home to Vedler's.
Right.
And I had worked the system without before I got fixed. My foot got fixed. I had a system where if I would lie on my belly in the cot and had this pipe. Bottom of the bed thing, mm-hmm. and a larger one at the top of the bed, and I'd lie on my stomach and put the bend in my foot on that tendon right there in the front of your foot
on that pipe.
The resting of the weight of the leg on the tendon of my foot would let me pass into sleep, because if I'd start to sleep, the pain would wake me right back up again. So, but with that foot on it. So that was my system for getting some sleep. It was really cool. So when I got to Cornelison's, I had a cast. I didn't have that problem anymore.
How did you get to Cornelison's?
Well, okay, she one day, this was the sad part for me. She came home. I came in. I was out playing in the trees with my cast on with the kids outside, totally unencumbered by this foot thing, and I came inside and she said, "I have to tell you that you can't live here anymore." She started like that. Oh man, that was awful. Because now what? You know, what's that mean?
And wasn't that because her older son was coming home?
Her older son was coming home. And he was going to have his bed. Coming home from. What was it, Korea or Vietnam or something? It was
probably Korea.
It was an awful, awful war.
1950.
Korea. Yeah, yeah. Because yeah. It was
50.
So, and he had gone for water. Three of them had gone for water, one in front of him and one behind him. The one in front got killed, bullet. And he kept going to get the water, and the one behind him followed him, bullet, dead. So, out of the three, he was the only one that didn't get shot. And he came back, and he they had some thing with inside his helmet or something. There was some sort of virus, and he'd lost all his hair. Came back bald. And he was always very quiet, you know. So he came back to live in the house. So I had to leave. So she said, "But I've called the lady whose son has been in my class. She taught first grade or something. And Peter was in her class. Like he was 7.
Wow.
And Phil was 4. So I've called them and I've tried to see if they'll take you in." And you can work for them, and that you can work for your board and stuff, and they'll try it out. If that works, then you can stay with them. And I was picturing this 2-story salt box in the middle of a field someplace out in the boonies. And so she said, she's coming this afternoon. Well, so she came, re-came in a light green Plymouth and parked there in the driveway. She had Peter and Phil with her in the back seat. And I said hi, and I took my crutches and got my way over to the car and sat in the passenger side and didn't know where I was going.
You have a suitcase or anything?
Nothing.
Anything?
I didn't own anything.
What about your nail file?
Part of the reason I went back to the house...
The toothbrush.
Part of the reason I went back to the house is my uncle had given me a pair of skates. Give me a pair of skates at a Christmas. He had taken Barbara and me with his wife Helen at Christmas time out to the stores asking us what we thought kids our age would want. Because they were going to give presents to 2 orphans.
Who is this?
My Uncle Ernie.
Oh, okay.
My mother's brother.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he kind of always looked after me, even when I was a baby. And so we went out with him, and I said, Erect-A-Set, and Barbara said, a dollhouse, and all this stuff. Well, Barbara got a doll, and I got a pair of hockey skates. But they were about 2 sizes too small. I couldn't wear them. And I didn't say much. But he asked me one time, you know, what? I said, well, I can't wear them. They're too small. So give them back to me. So I gave them back to him. And about 2 weeks later, he came by with a pair of white leather hockey skates.
I thought they were figure skates,
no? I think the first ones had to be figure skates. These were hockey skates. They had a wool tongue, sheep's wool tongue. And they were comfortable as a bugger. So I figured, okay, I can skate now. And when I came back from being in Massachusetts, I went to the house to see if I could find those skates. And when they took me out of school to take care of the kids, Jerry and Barbara, I used to take them over to the ballpark. I had all day, you know, take them over to the ballpark and let them run around over there. And I went tromping through the grass and down the slopes and stuff, and I found a ball that had no cover, but it had been black taped around it to hold it. And I found a bat that had been sheared, broken in half, but taped together with a tape all around it. So I had a bat and a ball. And I eventually found a glove over there that was looked like somebody flattened it. Well, a semi ran over it or something. It was all flat. Baseball glove had no pocket in it, but so I had the whole works: the glove, the ball, and the bat, and my skates. That's all I owned in the world. And I went over there, and nothing. There was nothing there. It was all gone. So it was a start over.
Okay.
So when I was,
jeez.
So that day at Cornelius's, we pulled into the yard. We went up into the driveway, and I thought, whoa, this is a salt box out in the middle of a field. It's a cozy little house, a little ranch-type house, garage, barn, flat-top barn, storage barn. We later built the superstructure over it.
Mm. Oh, so the floor of the upper part of the barn was the roof, basically?
Yeah, it was a storage barn with a flat top.
Mm-hmm.
and it didn't have a superstructure over it.
Right.
Flat roof, tar roof, or, you know, flat roof.
Wow.
And for a while, I used to help with the getting the apples in and the grading and stacking the apples in the storage. But then, when I got there, Phil, I was mixed up their names. Peter, there were double bunks here, and Peter was on the bottom bunk, and I was supposed to be on the top bunk that first day. And there was a crib in Bob Marie's room, bedroom, and Phil was still using the crib at 4. Mm. So they didn't have any privacy. They had the kid in with them.
Yeah.
And Peter was in the bunk thing. And I was, so the first night I stayed there, I got up the ladder and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do about the bed thing. So I just lay down on the bed, head on the pillow, and slept. Because I hadn't had sheets. I didn't know what they were. I didn't know how that worked.
I see what you mean.
But didn't you have those at Bedlers?
No. I had a blanket or something at the Bedlers.
Oh, wow.
I was, just had a cot. It was just a cot, you know.
So the backing up the spec, you get your first time there, you're on crutches, and he tells you not to get on the glass.
Right.
All that stuff.
Strike one. Dog says strike two. And then crash on the floor, strike three.
You had a big...
And then,
no, we didn't get that when we were talking an hour ago, but they had a huge Saint Bernard?
Saint Bernard, yeah.
I can't even imagine them having a dog in that little house, but...
No, it was an outside dog. It didn't live inside.
What was its name?
Beauty. I think it was Beauty. They had a Saint Bernard because when Bob was a kid, he couldn't swim, and he ended up in a pond, and the Saint Bernard swam out and grabbed him and pulled him to shore.
Wow.
Saved his life. So they had another Saint Bernard when they were...
I remember, now you said that you came in on your crutches and they slipped out from underneath you because of rugs on the floor. I remember that floor being really slippery when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. Butcher like waxed.
Butcher waxed.
I had to do it.
Yeah.
You know, on Saturdays he'd say, okay, you got to work for Mom. I mean, I don't know if he called her Mom. Probably called her Marie. I don't know. I never called her Mom. I couldn't get there. I couldn't do it. I had trouble with that. You know? My bio dad's girlfriend wanted me to call her Mom.
Yeah.
I couldn't figure that. So. So then that night, I just lay on the bed. The next morning, she said, did you sleep in the bed? I said, yeah. She said, well, the blankets are removed. I said, I don't know how that works. What do you mean? She was finding out. I don't know how that works. I didn't want to mess it up. I mean, I got a cast. It's going to make dust and stuff, and I don't know how that. These sheets things, I don't know how that goes. And so she said, well, look, if you pull back those sheets, there's more sheets, you slide yourself in, and don't worry about the dust and stuff. Those things get all washed. Figured it was a trap.
It was a trap. So. And the first day you were there, his Bob's wallet, Grandpa's
wallet.
Yeah,
he says his wallet, he lost his wallet. And I think he said it while we were at the table. And I just felt so... I was the elephant in the room. I felt so vulnerable about they're going to figure it was me. Mm. And I didn't know anything about it. I didn't even know he had a wallet. So, and then later in the evening, you know, like 7 or 8 in the evening, he said he found it and it was in a coat in his closet.
Did anybody ask you anything? Or was
no.
Anything?
No, nobody asked me anything. But I knew they were thinking it.
Or do you think you were thinking
I thought they were thinking it, but I knew they were thinking it.
That's funny.
Mm-hmm. And the meal that we had, you know, this is my first day. I've got all this stuff on a plate that I don't even know what it is. I had seen one of these vegetables in a jar of pickles in the A&P store. When I was walking down the aisle, I saw a jar, and they had these little white things that are part of the pickle assembly in the jar. It's just usually pickles are green. There was this albino thing living in there, like a tree or a...
White asparagus, maybe?
No, it was cauliflower or something.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm thinking, what's this? And then there were these little tiny cabbages, about that big.
Brussels sprouts.
Little tiny things.
Brussels sprouts. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't know either of these two things. These are foreign things I'm eating. What's up? And I figure, well, I'll eat it because I don't want to make a problem here, but this is, you know, where are the donuts?
So you didn't have great nutrition up to that point.
When my mother worked in the... And she worked in a buskets or whatever it was, and the drunks would come in at like 7 in the morning and start drinking. And I don't know that she ever delivered any food, but I remember, and she brought me with her because, you know, it's either that or find a babysitter, and they didn't have any money for that. So she brought me with her, and I was in the bar with her all day. I don't know how long she worked. And it started with a donut that was so fat that it didn't have a hole in it. It had, like, what could have been a belly button, but there was no hole, and it was just fat. And so that was my breakfast, and the orange soda drink was the drink. So I had donuts and soda. When I was with my father all that time, he was putting a sign up for Coca-Cola on a building outside. It's like a cobblestone wall, and they gave him free Cokes, so he'd come home. At breakfast we'd have Coke, and at night the supper was Coke.
Yeah, I wonder what the ingredients of Coke was back then.
It's probably mostly dope.
Yeah, that's gross.
Crazy. So that's that first day was really tough, but at least it was a beginning, you know. And I remember the good thing about that day was it was I think it was it might have been after supper, and he was noticing, you know, because I had this cast on him. Can you count on me for help? And he said he was going to go across the street and pick some apples. He had to pick some apples. It was apple time. Mm. And I said, I'll help you. And he said, what? No, I can get around. I can get around on my crutches. All right, that's not a problem. So he fixed me with a bag, picking bag straps. That's Maggie. And I went across the street, and we picked apples together over there. And he said, "Sir, do you ever go skiing?" And I said, "No." "Do you have any skis?" I said, "No, never been on skis, never owned a ski, never owned anything." Mm-hmm. So he said, "Well, maybe Santa will get you some skis." And I was thinking, "What am I into?" Mm. They're eating strange food. I can't even figure out the bed. I can't walk through the house. I fall on the floor. The dog wants to bite me. Can't keep off the grass. And now I'm trying to pick. And he believes in Santa. This guy believes in Santa. Because, you know, we didn't have any Christmases.
Did you have, that's as a sidebar, did you have any Christmas at all?
I had one. I had one that I remember. And we were living in Derry. And my mother's girlfriend, Sophie Bolesky, was there. She was with my mother that Christmas. And my stepfather was in Hawaii in the Marines. Mm. And Sophie had a tree, and it was decorated, and there were presents under the tree. We didn't know that till we got up in the morning. And they had the living room had these big doors. And you open up the doors, and there's a Christmas tree with presents under the tree.
Mm. How old are you?
It blew me away. Well, it was 1944 or so.
Nine?
Yeah.
9 years old?
And I looked at that like, what the heck is this? And there were presents for everybody under the tree. I remember getting a sticker gun that you could put a stick with a sucker on the end, and you cram it into the gun, and that gives it the propulsion. And you could shoot it across the room, and if you've got glass, it would stick to the glass.
Like a plunger?
Yeah, like a plunger. Mm. And as I remember, I had that sticker gun later when we lived in another part of Derry, across from the shoe shop. And Monahan was, we had a place was filled with drunks, and they'd all passed out or asleep. And I was up. So this was the next day, I think I was up. They all just crashed. And he had fallen asleep in a chair like this. And the cigarette had burned right through his fingers. And there was an ash that long on it. Still there. And he had sleep apnea, so he wouldn't even breathe for a long, long time. And he'd go, So he's sitting there. And so I had my sticker gun, and I'm trying to use two hands to see if I can knock that ash off.
Oh, my goodness.
You know? And I did. I finally knocked the ash off his cigarette. He didn't wake up. And then I noticed there was change on the stove. The stove was on. There was change, like half a dollar, a quarter, dimes and nickels, pennies. On the stove, they were hot. But I figured, well, you know, that's a lot of money to me. So I was trying to get those babies off the stove and pick them up, and he still was asleep. And I looked on the floor, there's a $20 bill and a $10 bill on the floor. Under the kitchen table. Whoa, baby. I figured I'm the richest man in the world. But I knew I couldn't keep it. It'd kill me. So when my mother got up, I told her. I found all this money on the stove. And I found this money under the table. She said, give it to me. And she would hide. She'd
it was like get 3 weeks' pay or whatever.
Yeah, she'd hide where she put it.
It probably didn't belong to her either.
No, it didn't belong to her either. But there was a lady in the front room. We had just like two rooms and two rooms and a kitchen. So one was a living room, one was a bedroom. This was their bedroom, this was my bedroom. There was a bath, and then it was a kitchen. So in the living room, people were crashed in there. One lady was crashed and she had these nylons on. And under the nylons were dollar bills, were bills. And they were hidden, they were not hidden, but they were in there. If somebody was going to steal her money, they'd have to wake her up to do it. You know? So I was thinking, that's a clever thing to do.
Good
money.
Yuck.
So that was... But that was, you talk about, it's sad too, because you're talking about you get up and you're trying to watch TV and there's somebody in there you don't even know. Mm. There's a whole house full of people I didn't know, except I knew the Monahan guy because he'd been there before.
See, that explains why it didn't bother you. It was something that you were used to in your childhood.
It was normal to me.
Yeah, yeah. But it was also two different motivations, probably. Like theirs is probably just drinking and, you know,
smoking,
yeah,
drinking.
But I remember as a college student going out with somebody and saying, let's go down to Coach's house. Mm. And I said, who? And he said, college counselor. He has keg parties and I spy parties. Yeah. And I thought, okay. And I'd heard kind of vaguely about it through the grapevine. I didn't know who he was because I was new there. But then when he brought me down to Row House, the door was open. Mm-hmm. He knocked and then just walked in. And I thought, I wasn't raised that way. So it was kind of, Whoa, you just walk into somebody's house. Nobody was there. So we left.
I was probably there.
I was thinking, how do you just walk into somebody's house? I mean,
Yeah.
I thought that was really odd.
Yeah, the open door policy.
Hmm? Yeah, that place was full. I think it was Wednesday nights when I Spy was on.
Oh.
All the kids were there. There was a grease mark from their heads sitting on the floor with the heads on the wall. All the couches were full. All the floor space was full.
Gross.
And it was...
I'm glad I came along.
For so many times. After so many times, there's a smudge along the wall where all the heads were. Remember we had a party there one time and Fat Fry was there and I was sitting on the couch in the TV room. He came by me and got me in a headlock. Mm. Just being him, I don't know. But his thumb or something was right in my ear, crunching it. And I thought, before I knew what I had done, I stood up and I had him in the air. Mm. And I was going to heave him out beside the TV. There was a window. Mm-hmm. I was going to heave him out the window. And I figured, no, there's the possibility he could even run over by a car if he doesn't know what he's doing, because the road was right there. So I turned around and I threw him against the wall, which would have been behind when he got me in a headlock, it would have been behind me. Mm-hmm. That wall. I threw him against that wall, and he slid down the wall behind the couch, the very couch I started the story with. Mm-hmm. And he finally pulled himself up off. He said, "Jeez, what's the matter with you?" I said, "Don't hurt me. Mm. Don't get me in a headlock. Don't hurt me. You hurt me, I go crazy."
Mm-hmm. So. Probably all that pent-up frustration from being hurt by Jimmy.
Well, if after a while, there's something you can do about it. But what? I don't know.
Jeez.
So that first day turned into a lifetime. Mm. And do you know the story about when Mrs. Vedler called her and said, get this 15-year-old boy that...
Yeah, tell it. You know.
And she said, be ashamed to waste him because he's bright, got ability and stuff, but, doesn't come from a good family. In fact, he's got no family. And then she said yes without talking to Bob. Mm. Because she had just got home from recuperating at the hospital from going in there to have her third child delivered. And her third child was a 12-pound tumor that she was giving birth to. It was eviscerating her. It was pulling her insides out. Mm. And the doctor didn't know what to do. And he had reached up inside her with a scalpel to try to cut some of it out. And then she started bleeding, hemorrhaging pretty bad from that.
Yeah.
And then they lost her. She could hear the nurse say, "I've lost her. There's no pulse." And she felt herself descending into a black abyss. And then she heard a voice say, "Your work is not finished." And she felt herself rising out of that abyss. And the nurse said, "Wait, I got a pulse." And they were trying to put blankets all over her and all stuff. So they tried to get her stabilized and then brought her in the operating room and did a hysterectomy on her and got rid of the tumor, but all her reproductive organs went bye-bye. So then she recuperated there in the hospital for a day or two and went home. And that's when the phone rang. Mm. And so I wrote a little story about it, and I said that, 32-year-old lady gives birth to a 15-year-old kid.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's really what it was. Because they stuck with me. The reason they adopted me when I was 30 was the two boys were fighting all the time, and she knew I'd be fair. She told me this. She knew I'd be fair, so they adopted me so that I could be the executor of their estate if they died, if something happened to them. Which was ironic because, Bob went, then Peter went, and there was only Marie and Phil, and Phil wasn't a good guy. But we found out she died because I got a letter that said, I'm an heir. And she'd left me some money. $10,000 or something, wasn't it?
$40,000, yes it was. It was $40,000 and she left $1,000 to each of the grandchildren.
I mean $40,000.
It's $40,000, Mom.
I thought it was $10,000.
Yeah. Well, so you lived, what, 15, but what grade were you in school? Were you in any kind of proper grade for a 15-year-old?
No, when I went to high school, I went for two marking terms, and then Jimmy pulled me out to take care of the kids, Barbara and Jerry. And so I was out of high school. So when I went to Cornelison's, Bob and I had a chat one day when it was raining like a bugger. We're standing in the grading room, and the water's pouring down like this, and he's looking out through the rain, and he said, you know, life is like a painting. The older you get, the more details are in the picture. And I said, you should go to school. You should go back to high school. And I was thinking about what he said. Like, you know, we usually talked apples. That was profound, what he was saying. So, because he used to like to paint. I mean, artistry. And for a birthday, I bought him a whole bunch of oils and a palette and stuff like that for him to paint with, and he never once used it. Those oils dried up. I bought him a fishing pole too, because he loved to fish. He told fishing stories. Never used the fishing pole either. It's too bad. He just all work. So he talked me into going back into high school, and I had no family. Pinkerton was a private school, but it served several little towns. Mostly at beginning, it was serving Derry. And though I had lived in Derry, and I was still living in Derry, but I had no parents paying taxes in the town to allow me to go to that school. So Evelyn Vedler and Marie Cornelison went to see Ivor Hackler, and they had a chat with him.
He was the
headmaster at Pinkerton Academy. And he'd been there. He was there forever. He was there like 40 years or something, a long, long time. So it was okay with him. Somehow they worked it out that I could go to school, go to Pinkerton. And I reluctantly went back to school. I said to Bob, you know, they're going to just ridicule me. You know, my whole class is ahead of me now. I'm a year behind. And I got to repeat that year.
Which year?
Well, it was 54, 55. I graduated in 54, so.
So you started over as a freshman.
I started over as a freshman. Yep, yeah, so, bummer. And true enough, they all ridiculed me. Like, because I got good grades when I went back to, as the second time.
Now. Yeah, so you're at least 2 years older than your classmates.
Yeah.
So if you graduated in 54. Four, okay. Then you were 19. Then you're a year and a half or whatever. Because most kids graduate when they're 17 or 18. You would have been
18. I know. It's awful. That's awful.
Yeah.
But in the counseling service was Ivor Hackler. And he called us all in, these seniors, when we were getting ready to graduate, because I was top boy. I had some girls in front of me, three or four girls.
Alicia was one.
Was she?
Yeah, wasn't she? You and she got all the honors.
Honors, but I don't know where she stood in the grade ranking.
Oh.
But anyway, so he called me in his office. He said, okay, you're going to UNH, and you're going to be a mechanical engineer. Next. You know, and I said, why? He said, because you can.
Oh.
Wow. Really? I didn't have to qualify or anything. I could just go from high school to UNH in the engineering department and matriculate through that, be an engineer. My father was an engineer, self-taught engineer.
Like a scholarship or something? Or?
Well, at the end of the graduation, I got... Two people got the boy and the girl got, well, usually it's boys and girls get awards, but I was the boy and I got all the awards. Alicia was the girl and she got all the awards. And I got the American Legion scholarship, the American Legion award, which was money and a medallion, and a McKinsey award, and the New England Kiwanis college scholarship award. They gave out one college scholarship in New England. And Mr. Hackler told me later, when I was in college, doing poorly, he came to my dorm, to my room.
Wow.
So, oh man, good to see you. What are you doing here? He said, well, I just want a little help with chat. What's one of your books? I was in engineering, so I had one of my books. He said, just read me that paragraph right there. Do you understand it? I said, yeah. Was that hard? I said, no. He says, what are you doing with a 1-1? You got to apply yourself in this. And how do you tell them? Look, I just want to get married. I want to have a shirt that's got my name in it. I want to have shoes that fit me. I want to have something of my own. I want my own family. You know, I'm tired of being somebody else's kid and somebody else's and somebody else's and somebody. You know, the heck with this. I'm tired of that. And I'm not concentrating on scholastic. I'm concentrating on relationships. And I want to find a wife. I want to get married. And of course, I was entertaining all the time. See, when we went to, there was a freshman camp. When you're going to UNH, there's an orientation for the freshmen. They call it freshman camp. So you go to this, and there's some entertainment, and there's some addressing issues, and some kind of hazing to get you to coalesce as a class, and the power went off in the whole place. So they started asking people if they could do anything to entertain the crowd, and I volunteered. And we could have a sing-along or something with the guitar, because I had done that at Pinkerton Academy. I sang like a big song with 5 or 6 girls singing around me.
At Pinkerton. What venue? Like a talent show or just like a pep rally or what?
No, it was probably some kind of a... We had plays, but we also had not so much a talent show, but a show. And they found out I could play the guitar, so they asked me to play it.
That had to be really new to you.
Walk on, also. Yeah. Pause it. Walk on with hope in your heart. You need to walk on.
Did you have a guitar in college?
I bought a guitar from Pete when I worked at the farm, when I was at the farm.
So that your guitar stuff started at 15.
Well, it started when I...
I mean, no earlier than that is what I'm saying.
It started when I was probably 9 or 10, because the guy next door used to come out and play the guitar on his doorstep next to where I lived, in Sleepy Hollow there, two, three houses away from Pete LaFerria. And I used to listen to him, watch his hands, and then the galleons used to... Mr. Galleon, the father of all those galleons, used to come down and babysit us once in a while. And he had a son named Leo who would pinch hit for that function every once in a while. And he had a guitar. And I watched him play the guitar, and I thought, well, how do you do that? And he put the guitar in my hand, and I'd put my finger on the lowest string. It's the highest string, but it's the lowest I can reach. And then I move it up to the one above it, and I would change chords. The last four strings would make a chord. and I, changing my finger one string would make another chord, so I could sing a song, a simple song with two chords that way. And that's how it began. And then he started showing me other chords, and pretty soon I learned what I call a hillbilly approach to guitars, not the orchestrational form to chords. But and then I used to play the guitar when I was at the Cornelius's. I'd go to the Cunningham's house, and they had fiddles and guitars and banjos, and they'd be playing the, like I went to the Prince Edward Island. Mm-hmm. That's how they do it there. And these people were from Prince Edward Island. So
that's that jig or what?
Yeah. They play like that all the time. So, and you, it doesn't take a lot of chords to play that. Well, pretty soon they were playing all kinds of songs, and I was playing with them. But I was having a chord change every three or four words. Mm. And they were wondering, they were playing three chords through the whole song. I was playing seven or eight, and they were going, "Where are you getting all?" And kind of ridiculing me. "Where are you getting all these chords?" And that was because I'd been shown by others that, you know, you can get the orchestrational chords. It's where you play it. Mm-hmm. You can freeze your hand like this and move it to where you know the chords are. A lot like the piano. Mm-hmm. So we had a, and those were good days playing those. That's one. And it, so, in French, when I class, my French class in Pinkerton, the lady that taught French said to me, "Your job is to bring your guitar in and translate this song, whatever it was, pick a song, to French." I had to translate it to French and sing it in French. So I only got B's and C's in the French course. But that French course got me through UNH French language requirement for an undergraduate for the bachelor's degree, and through, in Atlanta, the master's degree requirement, because Master of Arts, arts has to have a language, got me through that exam on what I learned in high school. It's just bizarre.
It sounds like she got you to engage, you know, by using the music.
Yeah, she did. She had me engaged, and but I was singing walk on with hope in your heart. It was like a production number.
Is that what you were just alluding to earlier with the girl singing behind you?
In Pinkerton. I used to go to, in Pinkerton, I'd go to the library. The librarian liked it when I'd come in there and bring my guitar in there and sing songs in the library, because nobody went to the library to study. They went in there to gossip and you know, so that was cool. So I used to do some of that. I did, even at UNH, I was in a band. I was playing in a band for electric guitar. So I bought that electric Les Paul Junior solid body guitar, electric guitar, from the barbershop people in UNH for like $168. And it's worth thousands today. I don't know how many thousands. But I played that guitar all the time, and I loaned it to the people at to Mike
Greenblatt and
Greenblatt and company at New England College when they were putting on Hair and those other shows. Yeah. I loaned them my guitar for them. When the show was over, they took it with them. And that's the Loego guitar. That was a wonderful guitar, though.
The amp. We had that amp for a long time, and we still do, but
little amp. I sold it at the yard sale at our house. It was still there at 802.
I used it through in high school, up in my bedroom in the third floor of the Deerfield house. I don't know where I got that silver tone. I had a silver tone electric guitar. I'm not sure where I got it.
I don't know, was that the one? That's not the one Pete gave me, because that was a Silverstone. It was at Sears.
I don't know. It was black. I think like black and white or silver or something. With the one weird round pickup. And I plugged it into that old Gibson amp.
Well, that fell out of my car and rolled down the road.
The amp did?
Yes. And I put it back in my car, went back to plug it in and try it again. It was perfect. And those were tubes.
Yeah.
Those were glass tubes.
I remember it just had the had a glass, a red glass on, indicating, you know, it had a metal toggle switch on and off.
Yep.
And that would light up the little metal glass crystally thing. And then it just had a volume knob and a tone knob.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. And it would boot. It would be pretty good for it. You think it's a little amp.
Yeah, it was probably like a, I don't know, it was an oval speaker, maybe 8 inches long and 5 or 6 inches.
And the back of it was open.
Yeah.
I figured, this thing's trashed now. It rolled out of my old Model A Ford.
That's funny. Yeah, I found somewhere an old, like a CB PA speaker that you would mount in the grill of the car. And I wired that to the speaker wires so that it would make that... the amp would come out of the amp speaker and that PA speaker.
Oh, for crying out loud.
So
stupid. I don't know that. I never knew that. That's cool stuff, though.